welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn and this is episode number 197 of the podcast, and it is the 3rd of October 2014 as I record this. So today I have an interview with Helen Sedwick, who is a lawyer or an attorney with 30 years experience and also a self-published author, and she's done a brilliant book on the legal aspects that you need to know as an author, including one of the most common questions I get asked, which is, how do I write memoir or non-fiction without getting sued? Also copyright and contractual stuff, things on image use, creative commons, and much more. I guarantee you will learn something in our chat, so hang out for that. In my news, Business for Authors is selling really well, which I'm quite surprised about, really, because I had thought that the audience would be small, but it turns out that there really is no other book like it on the market, and there seems to be a hungry audience for this kind of business information for creatives. So I actually think it may be, for once, I might be on time, as in normally I'm hideously early with what I'm doing, and with this I think that it possibly comes at a timely point in the rise of the indie market. So if you are interested, it's in print, audio and ebook formats at all the usual places and on my website at thecreativepen.com/businessbook. If you can't get enough of my voice and would like more audio, there's 6 whole hours of it. So industry news. There's been a flurry of new devices in the last few weeks, which is interesting. One of the Amazon did like 6 on the same day, but one was the Voyage, which is a high-end product, actually really pretty expensive. And, you know, I immediately went, oh, I'd like one of those, but my Paperwhite is, you know, still works brilliantly. So, but the Voyage is on my list because it looks kind of awesome. And I think this is interesting. And if you listen to the interview with Jen Tolte, we talk about formats a bit in that. But the Kindle 8 format, which is, you know, a much more beautiful, you know, I think we're on the cusp of beautiful ebook design, which is interesting because, you know, for a lot of years, people have said, oh, well, you know, print design will always outshine digital. But we could be heading into a time where ebook design is just as good. So I'm quite interested in that. The higher price also attracts a different crowd. I spoke at Independent Publishers Guild a few weeks ago. I've been doing way too much speaking. I'm very tired. But it's good, but I'm very tired. But yeah, I spoke there and, you know, this is very, let's call, say, the snobby end of the market, you know, people who really are in the higher echelons of publishing. And I heard somebody say, do you know, I think I might be really interested in that. And that higher price attracts that kind of crowd. And presumably they want higher priced ebooks as well. So really an interesting change. And even though, like, I personally don't really like formatting and stuff, if Kindle 8, you know, ends up being something that is, you know, there's a good tool to use or something, I am considering upskilling myself on formatting, because at the moment I just do the basics and I use Scrivener to just output basic files. But it has occurred to me that having nice looking ebook files might be nice and will be a differentiator in the future. Other things, I will probably do more of an update after Frankfurt Book Fair, which is next week. I will be going and speaking at a number of panels and sessions and doing a meet and greet with book bloggers. And there are 3 days in English, which is great, obviously, because my German is, non-existent. And I'll be taking business cards and some print books in German and, seeing how that goes. I'm also, now since I've, like the day after I launched Business for Authors, it's like, yay, I can write fiction again, because I just felt I needed to finish that project before I got into things. And I am 20,000 words into what is now called Gates of Hell. Oh, I just can't help myself, can I? It used to be, it was called Inquisition, which you might have heard me refer to. I always seem to do this. When I first think about an idea for a book, I have a name. I always have a title in mind. And then once I start writing, it kind of morphs into something else. And this time, as I started writing, the Inquisition plot is just, well, it just doesn't exist anymore. And I found some quotes and things. And anyway, so I'm really excited about Gates of Hell, 20,000 words in. It's the next Arcane novel. I'm loving it. It's really fun. I'm just blowing up lots of amazing architecture. It's one of my pet things to do. And Morgan Sierra is back. And Jake Timber is also back. If you were missing Jake, he is back from his devastating injuries. And so there we go. It's the closest I get to romantic, any kind of romantic or, you know, suspense or tension. Anyway, enough. I am concentrating on fiction for the next year. And I'm telling everybody I can, so you can all keep me honest. No more nonfiction until after September 2015. So I won't promise not to write any, but I will not be publishing any for another year. It will all be fiction. And I'm also doing Dean Wesley Smith's course on productivity right now, which is super helpful, as evidenced by my 20,000 words in 9 days, which is more than I've done ever in such a short period of time. And even makes me think that this year I will be able to finish or win NaNoWriMo. So I'm quite excited about that. So my aim is to finish the draft of Gates of Hell by the end of October, and so that I can spend November doing another book, which will be a new series, third series. Okay, so that's kind of my... Oh, and Dean Wesley Smith, you can find his courses at deanwesleysmith.com or WMG Publishing. He and Christine Catherine Rush have an amazing array of courses and lectures and things. And, you know, I consider them to be the fairy godparents of indie. They are so knowledgeable. And, you know, Dean's written... Well, they both have written, like, over 100 novels each. So, you know, talk about productive. Okay, so the podcast is going through a bit of a shift. I had almost decided to give it up. I know, it's crazy, isn't it? It does take a lot of time. I'm sure you can understand that. And, you know, when I was thinking about what my goals are around my books and my fiction and everything, and, you know, I thought, oh, I'll get to 200 and then I'll stop the podcast. And then when I thought about it, I just thought, I can't do it. You know, I love podcasting. I love interviewing people. And, you know, I love having you guys. And I think podcasting is actually going through a real renaissance right now. And so, you know, it'd be a crazy time to stop. Anyway, I enjoy it enough that it's good. So what I've also done is, you know, try and sort out a bit more compensation. So I have this year the corporate sponsorship, which pays for the hosting and the kind of technical aspects of the podcast, is split between the fantastic Kobe Writing Life and the amazing 99 Designs. And I'll be alternating with the ads. So today I'm talking about 99 Designs, where you can get a free power pack upgrade. And I know you've heard this on the other public self-publishing shows, but mine will be different. I promise my ad reads will be different. So my code, if you want to try 99 Designs, is 99designs.com/Joanna. So you may have heard from the other shows that 99 Designs does book covers, which they do, as well as logos, websites, apps, icons, business cards, email newsletter templates, which is quite useful, and much, much more. But they also do unique art and illustration, which is really cool. And so this is what I'm going to do with my first 99 Designs project. So I've just created a project to get a design for the key to the Gates of Hell for this next book, with the aim of using the image on my book cover. So basically, I created my account and chose the type of project, and then I could choose the type of service. So I chose, art illustration type of project. And then I could choose the type of service, and they have a number depending on your budget. Because obviously, if you're a real top, top designer, you might not choose a project that's on the low end of the budget. So I actually have gone the second to lowest budget for this. And then I put in some information about what I wanted. So I want something pretty demonic, you know, on the edge of horror, gates of hell. The phrase Gates of Hell brings up loads and loads of images in my head. So I was really kind of hoping that a designer would take that and run with it. And what's happened is in the last 24 hours, I've already had a number of designs and I've commented and discussed the ideas with some designers and I've rated some and then added some comments, you know, and we've done sort of questions in the questions section. And essentially, I'm really getting into this collaboration process of working with other creative minds. I really believe it's the future, and I will definitely be doing some co-writing in the next year or so. But in terms of this design project, you know, I'm really pleased with it. And what's so great about 99 Designs is if I don't end up liking any of them, I don't pay a thing. So there's no risk, which is very, very cool. So that's a bit of an introduction to what you can do with 99designs.com/Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A. So think about not just a book cover, although obviously a book cover is possibly one of the main things that most people would need to get done, but also a map for your world building, something that fantasy authors might be doing, or for example, they also have something else I'm considering, they have t-shirts. Design, and I'm thinking about potentially doing some kind of creative t-shirt around thecreativepen.com. I've always wanted to have some merchandise. You know, I've said before about the I am creative, I am an author affirmation that I started about 7-8 years ago now and completely changed my life. You know, that's something that I think people that would help people anyway. Once you actually go and have a look, you'll be, oh, I could do that. So it's very exciting. So 99designs.com/Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A, and get a free power pack upgrade. So there you go. There's my my new ad read. Yes, so that corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, but my time in producing this show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to the people supporting on Patreon, and a shout out, special shout out to Donna Grassman, who upped her contribution this month. Thank you so much, Donna, from $1 to $3 a show. And I'm really, you know, I'm thrilled about that. I think, thank you so much. You know, just to make it clear, even if I do more than two shows a month, I only include two shows as paid. So if you donate $1 a show, it's $2 a month maximum, no matter how many shows I do, which is normally three, to be honest. So you can support the show at patreon.com/thecreativepen. Or, of course, you can buy my books. So thank you very much to you all. I really appreciate it. And I've basically committed to another year of the podcast. So, yes, I hope you stick around. All right, here's the interview with Helen Sedwick. Hi, everyone. I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com. And today I'm here with Helen Sedwick. Hi, Helen.
Hi there.
It's great to have you on the show. So just as a little introduction, Helen is a California attorney with 30 years experience representing a diverse range of businesses and entrepreneurs. She writes historical fiction and has also written the Self-Publisher's Legal Handbook to help writers self-publish while minimizing legal risk. Now, I get questions every day, I reckon, about legal stuff. So Helen, just start by telling us a bit more about you and how you came to write fiction and self-publish when you're in this legal world.
Well, I actually, after in college, I studied creative writing and worked in advertising for a few years and wrote on the side. And then after being tired of being broke, I went to law school. And I think that is true of many people who try writing. We're also good students and bookish, and I went to law school. and always continued to write on the side. 30 years later and two children later, I now have more time for writing. A year and a half ago, I self-published my historical novel, Coyote Winds. And when I self-published that, I learned that there wasn't a legal guide to help self-publishers with all the various issues that they face. And I wanted to write that guide to help people out.
Which is fantastic. As I said, I think, you know, the rest of us are not lawyers, and you do bring this, you know, and my attitude is to tend to not to worry about it very much, but there are quite a lot of questions. So let's go through some of the common legal questions that come up in the book. Let's start with copyright, because some people are very confused about copyright. What is copyright, and what do authors sell if they sign with a traditional publisher?
A copyright is a piece of property, just like your house or your car or your bicycle. And it exists as soon as you capture your idea in writing. So you don't have to register it. You don't have to publish it. You don't have to correct the typos in it. You own the copyright as soon as you put it into writing or affix it into a piece of paper or a computer hard drive. It's always good to take the extra step of registering the copyright, but we can talk about that separately. When you are publishing it, whether you're traditionally publishing it or going through yourself publishing it, think of your copyright as being a large house with a lot of rooms in it. And you are the landlord, and you are basically letting out a few of the rooms. Some of them one of them is print, one is ebook, one's audiobook, one's the French translation, the Czechoslovakian translation. These are different rooms. Some of those rooms you may give exclusively. Only one person can enter that room. Let's say your publisher. Some may be like hallways, and it's non-exclusive. Many people can use it. And when you're doing self-publishing, you want to make sure your contracts are all non-exclusive, that you can print your books with CreateSpace and Ingram Spark, or you can have various options. So that's the way to think of copyright, as being you have pieces of rights, you have rooms in this building that you are going to let people use.
Well, that's a fantastic metaphor. And of course, like, one of my worst examples is a friend of mine in New Zealand who sold world English rights to all formats, ebook, print, audio, everything. And I was like, that you've just basically sold most of your house, right? What you should do is try and sell the least number of rooms in your house.
Absolutely. First, only the amount of time that's useful, and when do you get it back? Many people are intimidated by contracts. I joke that they think they look like 5,000 words run through a blender. So in my book, I take specific sections of contracts and I say, this is what the contract says and this is what it means. And writers can learn how to read the key provisions of the contract to find the kind of gotchas that your friend got. You know, it's looking at the grant of rights and termination, like how you get out of this deal if it's bad. If you learn how to read those two provisions, you're going to save yourself probably 95% of the time from making a bad mistake. And writers, if you can structure a novel, writers can learn how to read those two provisions of the contract.
Yeah.
I've taken it on myself to teach them.
Yeah. Just go into those two clauses a bit more. Just explain, what are those two clauses and why don't we like them?
When you are granting rights, you are selling somebody something. So you want to make it very clear what they're allowed to do, what they're not allowed to do, and how you are compensated for your property. And part of this is, I think writers tend to be shy about being salespeople, and that doesn't work to your benefit. You have to be a bit more tough than that. So what you want to look for is, if you are granting exclusive rights to anybody, You want to limit those to the rights that that publisher or distributor can actually exploit, is the word. Get out there and make money for both of you. If it's an ebook publisher and they want print rights, worldwide print rights in every language, in all formats, that's ridiculous. They can't use them to your advantage or to their advantage. And there are contracts out there that say that. And it's only an ebook distributor. So you want to only give exclusive rights to somebody who can actually make use of them. And in every other circumstance, it's non-exclusive rights, meaning that you can sell through various channels at the same time.
Mm. And the end, and then the other clause is how it ends, right?
Yes. If it's a traditional publishing contract, that's a highly negotiated item. It usually has to do with what your sales have been. If your sales, if they take you out of print, and defining what take you out of print means, then after a time you should be able to get your rights back. And this is so individualized. If it's a traditional publishing contract, which is usually an exclusive one, then it's worth hiring an attorney, because it's such an individual one-by-one case that you really need somebody to look at that contract. If it's self-publishing contract, then you want the contract to be terminable but on notice, like 5 days notice. I'm, in fact, this morning working on a blog post about an author's solutions company that not only do you have to give them 30 days notice to terminate, but then they can continue to sell your book in any format, in any language, for a year after you terminate. Which, if you're terminating them because you're moving on to a traditionally publishing contract, that's going to kill your deal. So you want to be able to terminate on notice in a self-publishing contract and be done.
Mm. And that's really important, because we're not just talking about signing with a traditional publisher. A lot of publishing on KDP, there's a contract, right? iBooks, there's a contract. There's a contract on every site we publish on. So, yes. And including, like you say, author solutions companies and other assisted self-publishing services have these contracts. But my big point is that authors need to remember it's not just one manuscript as such. What you're saying is it can be turned into all of these different things.
Correct. And usually all of that will be in the provision that's titled grant of rights or license. It will have language that will say, author hereby grants to publisher exclusive or non-exclusive, worldwide, perpetual, royalty-bearing, la-da-da, rights in print, digital, audio, and other formats, whether now existing or created in the future. Many contracts try to capture the future, every possible reality. Before you sign on that, you need to really understand if that's what you want to give.
Yeah.
And if that makes the most economic sense for you. And that may, it involves taking the time to read the contract. And if you don't understand, reach out to people in your writing group. There are many communities have lawyers for the arts that will help you out, particularly if you have a focus question like that, on the phone for no charge. You've worked for months, if not years, on your book. It's worth investing that bit of time and not losing it.
Mm. Right, let's move on to the next question I get, which is people wanting to quote things from other books, or they want to quote a poem or a song lyric, or they want to use somebody's artwork. So tell us a bit about fair use versus breaching copyright versus nightmare scenarios.
Okay. You should always assume that you need permission. And just look for the exceptions beyond that. The exceptions are fair use. If you're using, let's say, a quote or a photograph, and you're discussing the content of that quote, or you're discussing the content of that photograph for commentary, educational purposes, or even to make fun of it, a parody, all that is fair use. If you're using the photograph or the quote merely as decoration or a scene setting, that's not fair use. There's not a bright line in between those. There's a gray area. It's confusing because the courts are confused, and I think a lot of it's what the judge had for breakfast, as the joke goes. It's particularly hazardous to use poetry or lyrics. With lyrics, part of the reason is most music rights are owned by big music companies. They tend to be wanting to squeeze every penny they can out of their work, out of their intellectual property. So they're going to be less flexible than the artists themselves might have been. So the reason why writers often use lyrics in their novels as scene setting, because nothing takes you back to a smoky love-in than a song from the 60s. You can't do that without risk getting in trouble. You can use the title. You can use the title. You can say the name of the artist. You can describe how the song made you feel. You might be able to get away with a few words to kind of evoke it. But if you use two or three lines, you're inviting trouble. Mm. With photographs, if you're using on a blog post and it's kind of incidental to a blog post and not terribly commercial, probably no one's going to care. But if you're going to be using an image as your book cover or as a banner of your website and really feature it, do your homework and make sure you can actually use it without getting in trouble. And that homework, actually, I'm going to be coming out with the next week or so with a 99-cent ebook on Amazon that's titled How to Use Eye-Catching Images Without Paying a Fortune or a Lawyer. And I spell out, and for 99 cents, you know, this is a giveaway as far as I'm concerned. These are some nuts and bolts information on what is fair use, what is public domain, and if you have to track somebody down to get their permission, here's how you find them.
What about Creative Commons?
Creative Commons is wonderful, but there are a few tricks, which is if the Creative Commons photograph or image shows a person's recognizable face, or somebody else's artwork, like a sculpture or a poster, you don't know whether that photographer got the appropriate release from that model or for the underlying artwork. If it's a scenery or an animal or a cute little kitten and it's on Creative Commons, go for it. But if it's somebody, you know, it's a pretty girl and you don't know whether that pretty girl signed the right piece of paper, be a little more nervous.
And I have my Flickr account is Creative Commons, but it's non-commercial. So people can use my photos on their blog posts or, you know, giving stuff away, but they can't use those photos in their books, which they sell. So you can do that, can't you, with Creative Commons? You can actually specify how people can use those works.
Yes, in Creative Commons, there's a variety of different... What the artist does is the artist chooses how their work can be used, and they note it by an icon that they put on the work. And if you're going to be using a Creative Commons photograph, take 2 minutes and take a look to see whether you're using it in a way that's consistent with how the artist permitted the use, and also to give credit to the artist. If you're using it in your blog post, the best way is you put a little caption naming the original artist who created the image and make that caption a link back to the Flickr photograph, which gives more information about the artist.
Yeah, exactly. And I do that on pretty much every blog post and link back. And it's great. And also, like, I, with one of my books with desecration, I found an image on Pinterest, which I really wanted to use, but it was copyright. So I got in touch with the artist and said, you know, I would like to use this royalty free, which again is something important. And I didn't, you know, I said, you know, can I use it in my book, and got her permission, and she saw it as a marketing exercise. So she was happy to give me permission, you know, as long as I link to her site, and in all the books it gives her links. So there's no harm in asking permission, is there?
It's wonderful. It's we are all a community of creative people, and you will find, especially something on Pinterest where people are posting it there, they want to share this with the world. And maybe they'll charge you $50 for it, or maybe not at all. But it's the right way to do it, not just legally, but I think just as being part of the creative community.
No, I agree. So another question I get, another common question, is people who write memoir or nonfiction who are worried about getting sued. So what do you say to those people? And if they insist on going ahead, how can they best protect themselves?
This is the most common question I get. And it's the thing that worries writers. But if we didn't write about real people and real events, I think 95% of the books on the market would disappear. So that's the good news, is that it is commonly done. And it rarely leads to lawsuits. But let me give you, your listeners, some idea of the risks. If it's fiction, then mask the revealing characteristics about the person, whether it's physical or their character. It will both give you some more protection, but it may actually free you as a writer if you can, you know, make that person look and act a little bit different or blend different people. There have been very few cases where fiction writers have been successfully sued for defamation based upon fictional characters. And where they have is because the writer just wasn't even sensible and really just revealed a best friend's dirtiest and darkest secrets without trying to hide it at all. When you're dealing with memoir and nonfiction, of course, there you are identifying that person. My general advice is remember to show, not tell. Show what happened. Show the scenes, the reactions, your feelings. Lay it all out, but avoid attaching labels such as crook, idiot, pervert. I mean, there are all kinds of heavy labels out there. Trust that your readers are going to figure that out themselves. If you're worried about privacy issues, keep in mind that anything that happens in public, there isn't a right of privacy. This is, I'm talking about the United States. I realize that Britain is different this way. And if there's been a brutal court battle that's been part of this story, anything that's in public records from the court or testimony in court, in open court, you can use that. It's a great source of material. And then when in doubt, if you really think you're pushing the edge, then hire an attorney, and he or she doesn't have to read the whole manuscript, but you know, say, focus on specific chapters or how you handle a particular person.
And can you comment on the UK?
Not really, except that it's riskier for a writer in the UK.
Yeah, we have funny libel laws here.
You do have funny libel laws, but then you also have those really kind of scandalous journals and newspapers.
Yeah.
So this is the constant tension between privacy and the public's thirst for gossip. It's always going to be a tension, and and the courts don't always get it right.
Yeah. No, and it is interesting. I mean, you know, in my area, in the kind of religious stroke supernatural thriller, I mean, Dan Brown really took off, became a billion-dollar bestseller because the Vatican banned his book and reacted so strongly to what was supposedly fiction, you know, but he said, oh, this is based on truth, you know. So sometimes that edge, if you're on the right side of that edge, and I don't believe he has been successfully sued, you know, but that edge can be a good marketing tactic, right?
Absolutely. But it will also be stressful. Yeah. You know, but if you're going to just jump out there into the public forum and be controversial, like, for instance, another way to deal with touchy subjects is to use parody. If the story is really exaggerated and can't be true, you could actually, I think, be more devastating as a writer than if you're very truthful. I just think that is an option. If you're going to do satire and parody about true events and people, go over the top. Because at least in the United States, if something couldn't have been true, then it's not defamation. The classic case on this is that there was a writer who published an article in Penthouse about 30 years ago about a certain beauty queen whose sexual powers were so powerful that men's entire bodies levitated off the ground. Well, this particular beauty queen sued. And eventually she lost because the court said, while levitation is fascinating, it's not factual. It can't really have happened. So she ultimately lost the case because it was parody and could not have been the truth. And the whole point of defamation is someone saying someone is making a statement of fact that's damaging to someone's reputation. Well, this was a parody that could not have been fact, but probably was still just as damaging to her reputation.
Mm. Well, it's so interesting. I personally just steer clear of all of this stuff, but but I know some people are very passionate about doing that. Now, another question I get is around piracy and, you know, breach of copyright. What should authors be concerned about when it comes to piracy, and can they enforce copyright if they want to spend the time?
It is a time and resource question. All of us have limited amount of time and resource, particularly if we're working in addition to writing. And I think there's always going to be some piracy out there. When I look online, my legal handbook already, there are free PDF downloads available. Yes, I could send what's called a takedown notice. And I would say to your listeners and readers, look up takedown notice and it'll take you through details on how to do it. And you could get that site taken down, or at least that link to your book taken down. But you could spend a lot of time chasing down these pirates when they really aren't harming you that much, because anybody who's downloading a free PDF from them probably was never going to buy your book. Now, there can be people who are stealing so much from you that it is worth chasing them down. But some of it is just part of being in the business, and use your time writing your next book.
The one of the most pirated books is the Harry Potter series, and that hasn't done J.K. Rowling any harm.
Yeah.
She's like richer than the Queen. But also, I think, you know, really? As you know, I mean, the more your profile goes up as an author, the more these sites happen. And I used to jump on everything all the time, and now I don't even bother looking. And I think, I mean, some authors are even using piracy as a marketing kind of way of doing things. So, hopefully people aren't too bothered about that. Now, you also have a whole section on watching out for and avoiding scams, which is great in this kind of suddenly shark-infested waters of self-publishing. So without naming any names, obviously, how do indie authors watch out for and avoid these scams?
Well, reading the contract is a big one. But even before you do that, there are sites, there are online sites where people try to out these scams. Writers Beware, and I've listed some others that are not popping into my head right now. But I would do some searches online and maybe the name of the company or name of the individuals and then add scam or complaints to the end of it. Read the contracts. Look for credentials. There are a lot of people out there who are saying, making all kinds of claims about what they can do, the books they can sell, the editing they can do, the contacts. But when you look at their website, they have no resume, no credentials, no testimonials, or if they do have testimonials, you can't find those people anywhere else. If it's too good to be true, it's too good to be true. Keep in mind, somebody who's that successful probably is only working with people who can pay them a hell of a lot of money. So if they're looking for $500 or $1,000 or $1,500 contracts, they're small time, and they're not as good as they say they are. I think if they're particularly go after our older writers who are afraid of appearing out of touch, and they take advantage of that. They'll do a lot of technical mumbo jumbo and try to intimidate people. And take your time. Don't get sold on something really fast. Take your time to think it through. Don't worry about pleasing the person on the other end of the phone. Step back, ask for advice, do your research before you sign on.
And another thing I've noticed is a lot more competitions which charge entry. And what do you think about those?
My rule of thumb is I go to Goodreads, which has a list of contests, and you can link to who won those contests. I haven't checked lately, but if you have a contest, and I think Goodreads has hundreds of contests listed. If you go to Goodreads and that contest is not on Goodreads, then it has no prestige. I would not bother with it. If they're charging more than $50, they better be a big prestigious organization. Something like Writer's Digest may not be prestigious, but they are big. And I think if their entry fees are $100, $90, something like that. There, if you've won something from Writer's Digest, you are getting, they know that you've bubbled up among a very widespread and large number of competitive books. Or just accept the fact that you might win something that a prize that you put on your cover. And it's advertising. It's not really prestige. Is the other way to look at it.
Yeah, and I worry about a lot of indie authors still want validation from mm-hmm. other than from readers, and they feel like these competitions might give them validation. But as you say, I've just noticed so many, because I mean, I get emails every day from another competition that wants me to advertise them. And I'm like, how are there so many of these? It's just crazy.
Yeah, I do a list of like who's sponsoring it, how long have they been doing it, who links to their site, who are the judges? Are the judges unknown industry experts, or do they actually list their judges? I think that's very telling. And are those judges New York publishing professionals, or just another person with a website who's trying to sell services?
Yeah, we really, really have to be more and more kind of savvy, I feel, in this industry. So it's, and I know you provide a lot of information on your site, so people should definitely check that out. Now, another question, collaborations are becoming more and more common these days. And indeed, I have contracts with translators for kind of joint ventures. People do co-writing these days. What are some of the top things to watch out for and make sure you organize if you want to work with other people as an indie?
I would start small. I would start with a project it's a little bit like romance, a collaboration. There's a bit, there's chemistry and hard work. And I actually just did a long post on this and on Joel Freelander's site. I push people to put their collaboration agreement in writing. The process of talking through the issues and writing it down is actually more valuable than anything you put on paper. It just, it's like a prenuptial agreement for marriage. You know, people say it takes the romance out of it. Well, let's put romance aside and let's think about, if you're both going to be committing, or more than two of you, to a project, what you really want is to get to the end and get to the end successfully. So there are a number of things to consider, and to consider honestly. And it almost, we could spend a whole hour talking about those various quirks that make a collaboration work.
Mm. Well, I think, I mean, one of the big things, I think, with anything, like with an agent, I've had a couple of agents, is splitting up that partnership. So, you know, with collaboration, it's putting an end date. Like you said about traditional publishers, you've got to have methods and ways to end things and what happens if things end, right?
Yes, that is actually the touchiest thing, is if it doesn't work out, who gets what's left?
Yeah. Who gets the copyright?
Yes. One thing I say to writers is to start off by actually drawing a box and describing what's in the box that you jointly own and what's out of the box that you don't own, that you each individually own. And don't talk about it in vague terms. Make a box on a piece of paper and write down what's in and what's out. And you'll find that exercise incredibly helpful for seeing if you're both on the same page to begin with.
Mm. No, I think you're right. And I do like, I think my translation contracts are a couple of pages and they are just straight sentences of what's happening and who does what and, you know, dates and things like that. And it's amazing when you start looking at that box, what's in and what's out of that box. Even a basic list can go on for a couple of pages, you know, and how you're going to manage things like the money. You know, at the end of the day, a collaboration, the money has to go into somebody's bank account.
Yes. And in the US, and I think Britain's the same, the UK's the same, if you have a collaboration and you don't have it in writing, the law assumes it's a 50-50 collaboration. If it's three of you, it's 33% each. And either one of you, any member of that group, can sell the entire product. They have to share the profits. Mm. But anybody can sell off what you've created jointly. It's a quirk of the law, but that's what the law is. So one of the things you definitely want to get in writing is an agreement that nobody's going to go out and sell what you create without the consent of everybody in the group.
Oh, that's a good one. And yeah, this is the thing. But what we don't want to do with this chat is kind of scare people off doing these things. I actually think collaboration between creatives is the future. I mean, it's very much now, but it's the future as well. So don't be scared. And saying that, or not being scared, people are scared of attorneys like yourself. Yes. Although you're not scary, you're great. But you know, people are worried that they're going to have to pay thousands and thousands of dollars. They're worried that their attorney or their lawyer will just confuse them and that they'll feel stupid. And so how do indies, if they want an attorney or a lawyer, how do they find them and how do they work with them successfully?
As I mentioned earlier, there are organizations of attorneys who donate their time to help artists. There's a very active one here in California. I know New York has some. And so I would start with those organizations because you're getting a self-selected group of attorneys who are interested in helping out. And if you have a particular problem that's beyond what they can provide for free, they will have the connections to send you to somebody who is similar, who's a problem solver. The best attorneys, and I think most attorneys, are problem solvers. I run into those that who are not problem solvers. They just make problems. Try to avoid those attorneys. But so if you have to hire an attorney and you can't find one through one of these organizations, then start by asking other writers. And it doesn't have to be writers you know. If you've heard of a writer who's had a similar problem, contact that writer. Most of us writers, we love to talk. We love to write emails. We will share information. That's what we do. If you have an attorney, then it's important to tell the attorney the whole story from your point of view, and then also tell the attorney the story from your opponent's point of view, so that the attorney knows much more. You're better off telling the attorney too much information and letting the attorney sort through it for what's relevant than trying to only piece out little bits of information, because actually you'll end up with more confusion and spending more time if you do that.
No, I think that's good advice. And I have been through a divorce. So that was my only time really with that kind of legal situation. I've had houses and things, but, and what was it? It was an amicable split. So what we had actually done was create our own checklist of what we wanted to go through and how we would separate, and then that the lawyer helped us. But it was an interesting process, because I remember feeling very worried about talking to this person who I felt had more power. And it's interesting because I feel it's almost like the agent relationship and the publisher relationship. You feel like this person has more power than you do, and you know, and I think that's why some people resist going to see a lawyer or even asking a question. So I think your book is so helpful, and thank you for writing it, because clearly you could earn a lot more money not writing books for indies on on law. But in saying that, give us an overview of the things we haven't touched on, like what is in the book, what will people find in the book?
I try to walk through the process somewhat sequentially. First, I try to explain or get the mindset that if you are going into self-publishing, which is what I focused on, you are starting a business. And starting a business involves contracts, money going in and out, sales tax, nobody's favorite subject, how to hire freelancers. I look at hiring freelancers and how it's important to get a grant of rights of the work product back to you. I look at various self-publishing contracts that you'll run into and say, explain words like indemnification. That's probably the only legal term that I think, other than copyright, which is very common, but the only legal term that's not part of the common vernacular that someone needs to understand. So I go through explaining all of that. But even though I tried to cover a broad range of topics, I still get questions from people that I hadn't thought of. And so I welcome questions. You can either email me, contact me through my website, or post it as a comment on my blog, because I want to know what's confusing writers out there. Mm. Things I may take for granted because I've been doing this for half my life. Sometimes someone needs to ask me a question, and I pop myself on the head and say, of course I need to explain that. So there's a range of topics, but there's always going to be more to talk about.
Yeah, the second edition. I'm just doing the second edition of How to Market a Book. And goodness me, writing nonfiction, it doesn't stop, does it?
No, it doesn't. Let me see, other subjects. Like one thing I talk quite a bit about is that if you set up your self-publishing or freelance writing or traditional writing and you run it as a business, which takes a few steps, for instance, if you have a business name, registering that name, things that will take you an afternoon. If you set up your business correctly, then in the U.S., you're much better. You have a much stronger argument for deducting your losses, because you will have years in which you lose more money than you make, from other income. But in order to do that, it's called avoiding the hobby loss restrictions in order to not consider your, for tax reasons, in order for your business not to be considered a hobby, you have to treat it and set it up as a business. And so I do spend some time teaching writers how to do this, because most of us, this will not be a money-making adventure. We're doing it, we hope to break even, maybe make a little bit of money, but most of us are writing because of some other passion we have, or something we want to say and share to the world. And so we might as well get the IRS sharing in that, right?
That's a good perspective, because I always, you know, my goal is to be in the top 0.1% of authors who make their living making loads of money writing. But I know you're right, most people don't do that.
Well, we all hope it's a bestseller. And I do believe in planning for success.
Exactly.
As a bestseller. But you might as well. But the other way to look at it is, you are investing in a new business. If you're creating a book that's going to sell, you're starting a new business, just like anybody else is starting a new business. There are tax rules to give people who are starting a new business a break. Writers should take advantage of those tax breaks. You are investing time and money into a product and a business, not just a piece of art. And with a little bit of planning and organization, you can take advantage of these tax breaks.
Mm. Well, it's a fantastic book, and I think everyone should buy it. It's one of those, you know, it might not be so sexy, but it's really important. So, so that's fantastic. So where can people find you and your books and your blog online?
The book is available through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other booksellers. The ebook is currently just on Amazon, because I'm running some specials on Amazon, and Amazon makes you sign on exclusively with them if you run specials. My blog is helensedgwick.com and then /blog, but from my website, you can reach my blog. And I am open to, you know, I do answer questions that people email me. I give, you know, the disclaimer is I'm an attorney in California only, so what I'm providing both today and in my email is general information. That is not legal advice. It's just information, but information and knowledge is what 99% of the time, that's what people need, and that's what solves their problem.
Well, thank you so much, Helen. That was brilliant.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.